Over Hotchkiss's violent objections, the mayor ordered McCullough to study the right alternate route this time, to let Epstein oversee the study to make sure it was fair, and to complete the study before the board's next meeting when a final decision would be made. A defeat for Moses, the Post reported. The tenants felt it was. We felt we had won, Lillian Edelstein recalls. Epstein, trying to reassure her, had told her, in her words, it's like a jury trial. If they stay out long enough, they won't convict you. Because it was dragging so, month after month, I figured something is happening to hold him and his crew. On the day of the final hearing before McCullough, assembled in his office in the municipal building, was a full panoply of Moses men. Arthur S. Hotchkiss, Assistant General Manager of the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority, Stuart Constable, Acting Executive Officer of the New York City Department of Parks, W. Earl Andrews and Ernest J. Clark of Andrews, Clark & Buckley, Consulting Engineers, Milton Gowell, District Engineer, State Department of Public Works, District No. 10, designated to represent the State Department of Public Works by Bertram Ptolemy, Superintendent, Arthur B. Williams, Liaison Engineer, New York State Department of Public Works, and, representing Lyons, Edward J. Flanagan, who, during the entire proceedings, would utter not one word. These engineers and a dozen assistants had been assembled for the occasion on the orders of Robert Moses. Moses had been active in other ways, too. He had no doubt that Wagner would fall into line. Years later, asked if there had been no chance at all that the mayor would overrule him, he would, with a touch of surprise in his voice that it should be necessary to ask such a question, say flatly, "Not the slightest." But Epstein was delaying the mayor's compliance with his marching orders. The deputy mayor had to be whipped into line. During the week before the McCullough hearing, he was. Arriving at 10:30 a.m., the time they had been told the meeting would start, the five engineers representing the tenants were surprised to find it already underway. McCullough, they noted, seemed very uncomfortable. Although there were 15 Moses engineers in his office, the city engineer said that he would allow in only two of theirs, backing down only after an angry protest. Having learned something about Moses' methods, the tenants had hired a court reporter to make a verbatim transcript. Convinced that any reasons given for turning down their alternate route could easily be disproved, they wanted once and for all not only to find out what those reasons were, but to get them on the record. McCullough ordered the reporter out of the room. Angrily, the Aetna engineers demanded to know why, pointing out that the city engineer had his own stenotypist present, and that they were entitled to their own record. McCullough refused to give a reason. Later, in his official report of the proceedings, he said, "We were holding an engineering conference and not a public meeting." His own stenotypist, he said, would record any pertinent facts which might develop. "We said, if you're telling the truth, you should have no objection to its being recorded," one Aetna engineer recalls. They refused to participate in the meeting unless their reporter was allowed to be present. McCullough said flatly that there would be no meeting as long as the reporter remained in the room. The Aetna engineers asked him to get a ruling from Epstein. "Certainly," McCullough said. He telephoned the deputy mayor, and to their shock, Epstein ruled that they had no right to have a reporter present. The Aetna engineers held a hasty huddle. "We were afraid to go on the record without a stenographer," one, Leonard Swarth, would say. "It seemed peculiar that the others seemed to be afraid of having what they said set down in black and white." "It was obvious the cards were stacked," said Daniel J. O'Connell. They decided to walk out. Once they were safely gone, the meeting was held, as scheduled, McCullough blandly stated in his report to Wagner, and its participants arrived at the conclusion that the original plan was the only acceptable one, and that it would be impossible to accept the alternate route, a conclusion which may possibly be explained by the fact that the Moses men again managed to avoid discussing the true Aetna alternate route by discussing again the phony alternate Moses had put out as a smokescreen. Epstein was soon to give the tenants who had trusted him another shock. Repeatedly, month after month, after carefully examining the two routes, the deputy mayor had said theirs was the better. Now he suddenly changed his mind, and he put his new opinion in writing in a letter to Wagner. The tenants sent a telegram to Wagner appealing for an engineering discussion under proper circumstances. There was no reply, and of the Showdown Board of Estimate meeting, Katz was to write, "Dr. Swarth reported the results of the fiasco in the city engineer's office." The board was silent. They made no comment. They permitted all to talk. They made no interruptions or comments, asked no questions. The mayor set a time limit for public debate, and at the end of it called for the question, for acquisition of funds to acquire property and for building demolition. Lyons moved the question, saying, "This is an engineer's problem, not a layman's problem, and all the engineers unanimously support this route." One by one, the board members voted in the affirmative. The last man to vote was Robert F. Wagner, Jr. He voted in the affirmative, too. "It was so fast," Lillian Edelstein would recall years later. "I was positive at that last hearing that we would win, because of Wagner. He had said so straight out that he would never let them do it. He had promised." Lillian Edelstein wanted to ask the mayor what care he had taken for the families, what the relocation plans were. But she couldn't. She was crying. Katz asked instead. Lyons tried to stop him from speaking, but he went ahead anyway, quoting Wagner's words that he would not vote for acquisition until he had been satisfied as to the relocation plans. He asked the mayor what those plans were. The mayor said he did not know. Turning to Hotchkiss, Wagner asked about the plans. Hotchkiss said a new approach had been decided on. Instead of the city's own real estate bureau handling the job, it had been decided to let the job to a private firm, the highly efficient Nassau Management Company, Inc. As Katz was to write, "The mayor was assured that there would be few problems and that all families would be well provided for." Mayor Wagner asked Katz if this was satisfactory. He said no. Katz asked the coordinator's representative if that office would publicly agree to meet with the tenants' committee as a group and instruct the relocation bureau to do the same if the need arose to resolve problems. The coordinator's representative pledged to do so. Wagner, at any time of difficulty in resolving problems around relocation, wanted the tenants' committee to know that they could personally call upon the mayor's office to help. He made this last statement for the record. And why did Henry Epstein change his mind and, at the very last moment, betray the neighborhood which had counted on him for support? Years later, Epstein, long dead now, his widow not even knowing what the author was talking about when he raised the subject of her late husband's change of mind, Robert Moses, sitting in a cottage he had rented at Oak Beach, staring out the big window from which one could see the Robert Moses Causeway and Robert Moses State Park, would be asked that question. Charm flooded away from that window. Dressed in the L.L. Bean corduroys, a larger size now to cover the ample paunch, and an old button-down plaid shirt, the papers that signified completed work already piled high by his armchair, although it was only 9:30 a.m., a big cabin cruiser waiting down the ocean parkway at the Captree Basin for an afternoon's fishing, he was the easy and gracious host. The powerful face, still so young at 80, was relaxed. "Oh, that's not important," he said easily. "Let's talk about something else." The author said he had come to talk about Henry Epstein. The expression changed only slightly. The head swung just a little, but all of a sudden the author saw not the paunch, but the big shoulders and the big jaw, and, beneath the big eyebrows, the eyes. Then he could see Robert Moses remember that the author was a guest in his home. Moses began to talk, seemingly at a tangent, at first choosing his words, with pauses, and then warming up, as fast and fluid as usual. "It happened to be a very, very complicated thing. A lot of personal stuff got into it. They had a couple of agitators up there, including a woman who was running for judge, and Epstein got personal and nasty about it, and he finally got licked. I said, "This woman, this chum of yours." He said, "She's not my chum." I said, "Oh, yes, she is. She's your chum, all right." I said, "What's going to happen if we change the route, which we'll never do as long as I'm alive? We'll just be turning in these objectors for another set." And you know what he said? He said, "Well, that's in the next district, not Miss Schwartz's." He made an issue of it with the mayor to see who had more influence. He stopped as if that was all there was to say. The author prodded him. "Epstein was a very able lawyer," Moses said. "Outstanding lawyer. I had known him a long time." "Well," the author said, prodding some more, "he did write that letter saying your route was best." "Sure," Moses said, "after he was hit over the head with an axe." "What kind of an axe?" the author asked. "What exactly did you do to him?" But there were limits to even a host's obligations. "I won't tell you what we did to him," Robert Moses said. Reviewing the conversation carefully, however, it is possible to wonder if, without meaning to, Robert Moses had. About the Cross Bronx Expressway as a whole, Moses was more expansive. Asked if he had not felt a sense of awe of difficulties of a new immensity when, beginning active planning of the great road during the war, he had first seen the miles of apartment houses in his way, he said he had not. "There are more houses in the way than on Long Island," he said. "There are more people in the way, that's all. There's very little real hardship in the thing. There's a little discomfort, and even that is greatly exaggerated. The scale was new. That was all that was new about it. And by this time, there was the prospect of enough money to do things on this scale." Asked if he had ever feared that the tenants might defeat him, he said, "Nah, nobody could have stopped it." As a matter of fact, the East Tremont opposition hadn't really been much trouble at all. "I don't think they were too bad," Robert Moses said. "It was a political thing that stirred up the animals there. Jim Lyons didn't know which way to turn, but I just stood pat, that's all." New York's press also didn't see much significance in the East Tremont fight. The Post gave it complete coverage, of course, and the World Telegram occasionally devoted a fairly detailed story to it, but, aside from Moses' single personal appearance before the Board of Estimate, on the occasion of which the Times put his picture on page one, the rest of the city's big dailies all but ignored it. When they did devote space to it, a paragraph or two at the bottom of a roundup of board activities, the attitude they displayed is of interest. This, for example, was the Times' description of the final climactic hearing at which Lillian Edelstein sat crying in City Hall. 5 years of opposition and delay to the Cross Bronx Expressway came to an end when the Board of Estimate unanimously voted to acquire land for a one-quarter, sick, mile segment of the middle section. The fight put up by the tenants resulted in a virtual stalling of the overall Cross Bronx Expressway project, since the two ends of the artery are now finished. Why wouldn't Moses shift the route of the Cross Bronx Expressway slightly, thereby saving 1,530 apartments, millions in state and city money, months of aggravation and delay, and making his expressway straighter as well? "I asked George Spargo that," says Joseph Ingraham, the Times reporter who was occasionally on Moses' payroll and who spent so much time socializing with the Moses team that he sometimes seemed to be one of its members. On the day of the ribbon cutting, they were opening a whole bunch of sections of different expressways, and it was raining, really pouring. George said, "Let's sit this out, and we'll catch up to them at the next stop." We went into a small bar in the Bronx, and I asked him there. He said, "Oh, one of Jimmy Lyon's relatives owns a piece of property up there, and we would have had to take it if we used that other route, and Jimmy didn't want it taken, and R.M. had promised him we wouldn't." At the time, George even told me the piece of property involved, but I've forgotten. The people of East Tremont also wondered why Moses wouldn't shift the route. "I mean, we heard lots of rumors about the bus terminal," Lillian Edelstein recalls. The politicians were always trying to tell us that was the reason, but we could never find out anything about it. And I mean, I never believed that. I could never believe that even Robert Moses would take 1,500 homes just to save a bus terminal. Spargo's statement may have been untrue. So may the rumors. If any relative of Bronx Borough President James J. Lyons owned property along either the alternate or actual expressway route, the author was unable to find evidence of that fact. Although, since, in the Bronx, politicians' ownership of property was habitually concealed through a many-layered network of intermediaries and bagmen, a network baffling even to contemporary investigators, and all but impenetrable 20 years later, his failure is not conclusive. Moses' refusal to alter the route, unexplainable on the basis of his given reasons, all of which are demonstrably false, may have had nothing to do with the fact that the bus terminal of which Lillian Edelstein speaks, actually the Tremont Depot of the 3rd Avenue Transit Company at the northeast corner of Crotona Park, lies in the path of the alternate route and would have had to be condemned if that route was adopted. It is possible that Moses' selection of the original route, it was he, not any engineer, who selected it, was based on no more than whim, and that his subsequent refusal to alter it was due to nothing more than stubbornness, although if so, it was a whim quite inconsistent with Moses' customary whims. Almost invariably over a period of 40 years, whenever he had a choice of routes, he selected the one that would keep his road straight, not the one that would make the road curve. However, in attempting to find an explanation for Moses' refusal to change the route, the 3rd Avenue Transit Depot stands out. With the exception of 6 old, small, dilapidated brownstone tenements, housing a total of 19 families, it was the only structure of any type that would have had to be condemned if the alternate route was used. In effect, for whatever reason, Robert Moses elected to tear down 159 buildings housing 1,530 families instead of tearing down 6 buildings housing 19 families and the terminal. It is a fact that the 3rd Avenue Transit Company secretly told Moses it was very anxious not to have the terminal condemned, for its location was strategic for its buses. And it is also a fact that for 20 years it was considered an open secret in Bronx political circles that key borough politicians held large but carefully hidden interests in 3rd Avenue Transit. And it is also a fact that, in Bronx politics of the period, what 3rd Avenue Transit wanted, 3rd Avenue Transit got. But the unfortunate element in searching for the explanation of Moses' refusal is that, in the perspective of the history of New York City, it is unimportant. Whether Moses refused to change the route for a personal or political reason, the point is that his reason was the only one that counted. Neighborhood feelings, urban planning considerations, cost, aesthetics, common humanity, common sense, none of these mattered in laying out the routes of New York's great roads. The only consideration that mattered was Robert Moses' will. He had the power to impose it on New York. Highly efficient was the only description of the Nassau Management Company given at the Board of Estimate hearing. A more detailed description would have been instructive. Nassau Management had been founded 3 years before on a shoestring with virtually no financial resources behind it. But it was almost immediately to obtain immense tenant relocation contracts for several Robert Moses highway and housing projects. One contract alone netted the firm more than $2 million. The men who owned stock in Nassau Management thus made fortunes without risking more than a token investment. The ostensible key men behind the authority, its founders of record, were 2 low-echelon City Housing Authority employees who quit the authority to form the firm. But they were only front men. The key figures behind Nassau Management, men who would profit from the relocation of the East Tremont tenants, were William S. Leibhol, Counsel of the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority, Samuel Brooks, Assistant Director of the Mayor's Slum Clearance Committee, and Housing Authority Chairman Philip J. Cruz, 3 of Moses' key aides. First Man. After a lifetime, a piece of paper, an edict from the authorities, and we must all leave our homes. Mendel. Rabbi, we've been waiting for the Messiah all our lives. Wouldn't this be a good time for him to come? Rabbi, we'll have to wait for him someplace else. Meanwhile, let's start packing. Fiddler on the Roof. It must have been an accident that the East Tremont office opened by the highly efficient Nassau Management Company was located not in East Tremont, but in West Farms, another neighborhood, inconveniently far away for the 1,530 families the office was supposed to serve. It must have been an accident that the office was open only a few hours a day, that those hours were constantly changing, that no notice was ever given of what those hours were going to be, and that inquiring about them by telephone was almost impossible, since the single phone number listed for the office seemed to be always busy, so that often East Tremont housewives, having made the long trek over to West Farms, found waiting for them only a locked door. It must also have been an accident that there were never enough company representatives in the office, so that the housewives waiting for help had to wait on long lines. But East Tremont's housewives soon found, as one put it, they didn't want to help you, they just wanted you out, and they wanted you out fast. A series of incentives was placed before the tenants to accomplish this end. On her first trip to the office, a housewife was not offered any help in finding a new home. Instead, she was told that if Nassau management had to find her one, she would receive only $100 for moving expenses, far less than would be needed to cover those expenses. If she found one herself, she was told, she would receive $100 for each room in her present apartment. If she found one fast, she was told, she would receive a flat fee of $800. And if she found one real fast, she would get not only $800, but reimbursement for moving expenses, actual moving expenses. It was only if you refused to accept these incentives and insisted on the help that had been promised that you were given two cards, each bearing an address of an available apartment comparable to the one you now occupied. "I went to one," a housewife recalls. "This was in the West Bronx. It was a walk-up, four flights of stairs. The apartment was on the top floor, and there was already a line there of women that had been sent over. People were standing on the staircase, all down the four flights and outside. What was the sense of standing on line? If the apartment was decent at all, someone else would have taken it. What was the sense of sending hundreds of women to look at one darn apartment? I went home." Lillian Roberts waited on such a line. "When I finally got to the apartment, it wasn't comparable at all. It was so dark and crummy. It was only three rooms, and I had told them I had four. And they wanted twice as much rent as I was paying, for that filthy thing. I still remember it. Horrible. I wouldn't go back to that office again." Some housewives were so desperate that they did go back. Women who would never have believed that they would ever be in such a desperate position found themselves standing around a bare storefront office, hour after hour, day after day, like beggars, one says bitterly, hoping that someone would give them a home. Sometimes, when a woman got to the address Nassau management had given her, there was no one around to let her in. If she was lucky enough to find a superintendent or a janitor, he sometimes told her that the apartment was not vacant, hadn't been for months. Back they went, day after day, from the apartments they had been sent to see in the West Bronx or Riverdale or Throgs Neck, back to the Nassau management office, and then out again in a search for something they knew now they were never going to find. "I remember that winter," says one of these women. "I got old that winter." If you still refused to accept either the apartments that were offered or the cash, other incentives were applied. "As soon as the city took over, the superintendents moved out," Lillian Edelstein recalls. "They got other jobs. You couldn't blame them, but you couldn't get any kind of services. The halls got dirty. There was garbage to take out. I went to fight," Mrs. Edelstein says. But Nassau management said the Real Estate Bureau was responsible for maintaining the buildings. The tenants protested to the Real Estate Bureau, but the only result, as Mrs. Edelstein recalls it, was that they assigned one man to take care of six or eight buildings, and soon he was gone too. And always the final answer was that on all matters pertaining to the Cross Bronx Expressway, the final say had to come from Robert Moses. Katz had asked Moses' representative if that office would publicly agree to meet with the Tenants Committee, if the need arose to resolve problems, and Hotchkiss had made that agreement. Now they called Moses and Hotchkiss. We never even got a reply. They telephoned Wagner's office. Wagner had wanted the Tenants Committee to know they could personally call upon the mayor's office to help. Ah, we never got him on the phone, or anyone else but a secretary, one Aetna member says. They started bouncing us back and forth to the agencies again. The city formally took title to the 159 buildings in Section 2 on January 1, 1954. Almost simultaneously, the heat and hot water in many of the buildings was mysteriously cut off. 11 days later, 11 days of getting the same runaround from the city and the same lack of response from Moses' office, they told their story to the Post. The Post got an answer from Benjamin Simrot, executive director of the Real Estate Bureau. Repairs take time, and we are working as quickly as we can. Essential services will be maintained. But Simrot's definition of essential services was evidently different from the tenants. For many of them, for much of the winter, the only warmth in their apartments was provided by the little, inadequate electric heaters they purchased themselves, or by gas ranges they kept turned on all the time, and the only hot water was the water they heated in pots. There were a few desultory attempts at repairs, but many of the buildings had no heat or hot water for weeks at a time. One had none for 3 straight months. Incentive to get out was provided also by mortification of the mind. Nassau management said they were only obligated to show you 2 apartments, Mrs. Edelstein recalls. If you turned down 2 apartments that they offered you, they said they were through with you. They said either you get out on your own or they dispossess you. They said they'd put you out in the street. The threat was backed up by dispossess notices, all designed to look like court orders, although they were not, each couched in language more urgent and ominous than the last. On May 1st, a Friday, every tenant remaining in the area received one, ordering him to vacate or be evicted by the end of the month. After a weekend of hysteria, a tenants committee accompanied by Councilman Lewis Peck was able to see Percy Gale, director of the City Real Estate Bureau. Luckily for them, they had brought a Post reporter along. Gale hastily explained that the notices were only a necessary legal prerequisite, to what he didn't say, and that no one will be evicted if they do not vacate at the end of 30 days. The escalation of incentives produced the desired results. More than 1,000 of the 1,530 families had stuck it out through the terrible winter because the alternatives were so shattering. What choices did most of them have? Lillian Edelstein asks. Either to move to apartments for the same rent they were paying, which meant for most of them moving to the slums, or to move above their means, which would be a great, great hardship for these people. In the spring, however, they began to move out faster and faster. The old people clung hardest. They were the ones I really felt sorry for, Lillian Roberts says. These were very poor old people. Social Security had come too late for many of them, and many of them were alone in their little apartments, the parents or wives or husbands who had come with them from the little shtetls of their youth gone now. There were a lot of widows in East Tremont. But as long as they could stay in their tiny apartments, on the first or second floor mostly, because stairs are hard on old people, they had something. The Senior Citizens Program at the Y, familiar places to sit and stroll in the sun, and most important, companionship. If they had to move, they would have nothing. Impoverished elderly couples were eligible for apartments in City Housing Authority projects. But although there were at that time a number of authority projects under construction, the authority's Moses-dominated board was deaf to these couples' pleas that a substantial number of them be allowed to move into the same project, so that they could stay together. Couples eligible for apartments in projects had no choice but to take them. They could not afford decent living accommodations anywhere else. impoverished elderly men and women who were alone in the world were not eligible for authority projects. The Moses-controlled authority made no provisions for single people. Such men and women had no choice at all to stay together. "Do you know how poor they were?" Lillian Roberts says. "They didn't have the car fare to visit each other." The old people of East Tremont were terribly frightened of moving, but Robert Moses had made certain they would be more frightened of staying. One by one, faster and faster, the old people moved out too. By June, half the 1,530 apartments were vacant. Their emptiness made possible the application of new incentives. As soon as the top floor of a building was empty, they'd start tearing off the roof and the top stories even, says Mrs. Edelstein. While people were still living in it, they were tearing it down around their heads. As soon as an apartment was vacated, moreover, its windows were boarded up, which advertised to vandals defenseless premises available for the plundering. Watchmen were apparently a luxury neither the city nor Nassau management could afford. The other tenants could hear the vandals at night, tearing the plumbing out of the walls for money, ripping the boards off the windows and breaking the glass for sheer malice, throwing bricks and other debris off the roofs to hear them crash when they hit the ground. Then, Mrs. Lucille Silverstein says, started the muggings. Soon the people living in those half-empty buildings, lonely, scared, many of them old and alone, weren't safe in their own lobbies or on the flights of stairs, which suddenly seemed terribly long and dark. Terror, that most efficient of eviction agents, stalked through that boarded-up, half-empty neighborhood. Along that mile now, most of the one- and two-family frame houses had been demolished. As the demolition crews worked, they had piled the lumber they were tearing apart in the backyards of those houses, and when they left, they had left the lumber there in piles 25 and 30 feet high, stacked as if for a bonfire. Soon, thanks to vandals, the bonfires blazed, and the remaining apartment houses stood not only among these heaps of lumber, but among gaping, debris-filled pits, some 30 feet deep, the basements of what had once been other apartment houses. Into one, someone had driven an automobile, and it lay there, stripped and abandoned, for months. To mark the site of other apartment houses, there were jagged-topped brick walls, 10 or 12 feet high, and the space between those walls was filled with bricks, sharp-edged shafts of steel, and shards of broken glass. "The rats were running like dogs and cats in the street," Lillian Edelstein says. So thick was the grime hurled in clouds into the air by the demolition that Dominic Tassone, hanging desperately onto his three-family frame house, spoke of living in dust storms. Unsupervised children walked single file along the tops of those brick walls, trying, as children do, to see who could keep longest from falling. But if they fell, it was onto those shafts and shards. There were no fences around those gaping pits. Parents lived in fear that their kids would fall into them. One mother, who normally picked up her two little boys at school every day, was late one day, and, hurrying along the route they took home, saw them jumping back and forth across a hole in the street. Rushing up to them, she saw that the hole was perhaps 20 feet deep. The people still left along the mile were the last holdouts against what they regarded as injustice. Tassone was informed that he could receive only $11,000 for his three-family frame house, because Moses had established that as the price for all the frame buildings along that mile. "They gave $11,000 for a one-family shack. They gave the same to all the houses along the way," Tassone says. "Mine was a good house. It wasn't fair." The appraisal he commissioned set its value at $18,000. The city representative said that appraisal might well be fair, but that didn't matter. $11,000 was the price. Tassone had hired a lawyer and was going to fight on. Other people were still left along the mile because they had no place else to go. The family with 11 children, for example, had been unable to find any landlord, at any price, who would give them an apartment. The city housing authority had promised them one, but kept saying that no apartment large enough was yet available. The people who were left were still hoping that the city and Robert Moses would keep the promises they had made. They tried to protest. They called the city agencies, pleading that watchmen be assigned to the area and that fences be erected to keep children from falling into the pits. Surely, they said, with hundreds of workmen in the area, a few could be spared to put up fences. But always, after being shunted from one agency to another, they were eventually told that the State Department of Public Works was in charge of all physical arrangements in the area, and when they called the state DPW, the answer was that while the DPW was technically in charge, the actual work was being carried out under the direction of the city construction coordinator, and he was the only one who could help them. And when they called the coordinator's office, they were never able to speak to anyone except secretaries, who told them that someone would call them back, and no one ever did. Water and electricity were suddenly and mysteriously cut off, and when, after protests to city agencies were publicized by the Post, they were restored, they were suddenly and mysteriously cut off again. Tassone's home shared a firewall with the adjoining building. One day, while Tassone was still living on one side of that wall, demolition began on the house on the other side of that wall. He could see his wall being weakened by vibrations. "One day it'll come right down on us," he said. Telling his lawyers to drop his appeal, he moved out. And always there were the threats. Speed was essential, the Nassau Management Company kept saying. Work on the expressway itself was going to begin any day, and as soon as it did, anyone left in the area would be put out in the street with no further warning. "That was all I heard," one holdout remembers. "If you don't get out, we'll put you out in the street." Out in the street. Out in the street. As the Tsar had harried them, or their fathers, or their grandfathers, out of the shtetls of the Pale, the coordinator harried them out of East Tremont. By November, the Nassau Management Company could proudly announce, "In less than 10 months, we have relocated 90% of the 1,530 occupants of Section 2. Chapter 38. 1 mile afterward. After the tenants had been rushed out of their homes, it turned out that there had been no real need to rush after all. To obtain the initial state consent to build the Cross Bronx Expressway, Moses had, as usual, drastically underestimated its cost, which inflation was pushing higher by the month anyway. By the time, November 1955, that Nassau management boasted that almost all the tenants were gone, so was almost all the state's highway construction fund, which had to bear half the expressway's cost. Passage of a referendum authorizing a new bond issue for highways would, in 1956, give the state another $400 million. But the state was not anxious to spend this new money on the Cross Bronx. With congestion on Moses Bronx Whitestone Bridge worsening, by 1955 he was allocating Triborough funds for another Throgs Neck span on the east, and the expressway would have to be extended eastward to reach it. With congestion on the George Washington Bridge at the expressway's western end also worsening, and with two intersecting Moses expressways already under construction, the Sheridan, named after engineer Arthur Sheridan, and the Bruckner, named after longtime Bronx Borough President Henry Bruckner, obviously going to dump even more traffic onto the Cross Bronx, it was apparent even before its tragic mile through East Tremont had been cleared that traffic on the Cross Bronx was going to be immensely heavier than expected, too heavy to possibly be accommodated on the old Washington, not the George, bridge, constructed in 1888 under the sponsorship of George Washington Plunkett, on which the road had been expected to cross the Harlem River. Moses decided to build a new bridge, the Alexander Hamilton, right next to the Washington. Designing the expressway extension and the Hamilton Bridge, particularly the bridge, for immense curls of cloverleaf spaghetti would be required to link it to the Deegan and Harlem River highways flanking the river more than 100 feet below, would take an estimated 18 months. Obviously, the Cross Bronx Expressway was not going to be finished, or anywhere near finished, for years. There were other highways around the state that could be finished sooner, In time, say, for the 1958 gubernatorial election, for which Averill Harriman was so anxious to be able to cut ribbons, and the money might better be spent on them. Moreover, the colossal true cost of the Cross Bronx could no longer be concealed. Before it was finished, the highway, including its interchanges with other highways and the bridge carrying it over the Harlem, would be the most expensive road constructed in all history, would cost not the $47 million that Moses had originally estimated, but $250 million. Now that Moses had cleared the right-of-way for the expressway, he had no money to build it, and in fact was not able to get it underway again, except on a token construction scale, until 1957, after the Federal Interstate Highway Act of 1956 had authorized an increase in the federal contribution from 50 to 90%. Even then, moreover, there would be continual delays. Bids came in far over contract estimates. New estimates would have to be prepared, and new rounds of bidding held. Construction of the final segment of the Cross Bronx Expressway, the Bruckner Traffic Circle near its eastern end, would not be completed until 1973. The rest of the Cross Bronx Expressway would not be completed until 1963, and the 1 mile of the expressway in East Tremont would not be completed until 1960, 5 years after Moses had removed from that mile the people who lived in it. 5,000 people had been removed from East Tremont, but that was 5,000 out of 60,000. There were still 55,000 left. Chance, moreover, had spared East Tremont the fate of other communities disemboweled by a Moses Highway operation. The heart of this community, bustling East Tremont Avenue, had escaped the coordinator's scalpel. But the thuds of the skullcracker, the huge swinging wrecking ball, the crash of crumbling walls and the rumble of trucks carrying the walls away had been merely a prelude. The rattle of rifle fire from a skirmisher's picket line before the battle is fully joined and the big guns come into play. For Moses Cross Bronx Expressway had been designed by a single criterion, its efficiency as a traffic moving device. This meant keeping the expressway as level as possible, and East Tremont was a neighborhood of hills. To keep the grade down, we had to go down, Ernie Clark explains. Going down meant going under the surface of East Tremont, and under that surface was solid rock, and there was only one way to get rid of solid rock. First you heard the sound, and then a few seconds later you felt the tremor, like a rumbling in the earth, a shaking under your feet, recalls Barney Lambert, whose office was 7 blocks away. The sound of the explosions of the huge masses of dynamite required was a boom, a real boom, like a bomb, says Mrs. Silverstein. The whole neighborhood seemed to be shaking. It was shaking. The blasting found out every flaw in the earth under East Tremont. It caused the bed of a subterranean river beneath Southern Boulevard to shift. Mortar and brick were jarred loose from one end of the neighborhood to the other. As apartment houses settled or were pushed up as the earth beneath them heaved, huge gaping fissures began to appear in their walls and ceilings. Tenants were hastily evacuated, some in the middle of the night. Lambert and Mrs. Silverstein lived blocks away from the blasting. People who lived closer felt as if they were at ground zero in an air raid. The scene in the great excavation, a deep gash in the earth, 120 and more feet wide and a mile long, was fantastic. Looming through the clouds of dust were a mile of tall cranes, huge earth-moving machines, batteries of bulldozers, battalions of trucks, and an army of men, their helmets glinting through the dust stretching away as far as the eye could see. At intervals, red flags would be unfurled, and men in pairs would carry them up to the streets crossing the excavation, and, standing well away from the excavation, wave traffic to a halt. Then, at some signal that could not be discerned from above, the men down in the pit would all run to take shelter behind their equipment. There would be a pause, and then the explosion would come, and the giant steel mesh mats that had been placed over the explosion areas would rise in the air and fly several feet away as if they were bits of carpet. Sometimes long black limousines would pull up to the edge of the embankment and men carrying rolls of maps and blueprints under their arms would clamber out and scramble down the embankments with their aides, and even if the residents did not know that these were the general staff of the campaign, Colonel Chapin and General Farrell, who had built highways through jungles, Captain Prager, who had built the Normandy invasion dry docks, there was no mistaking the commander-in-chief. For sometimes, in the late afternoon, the longest black limousine of them all would pull up, generally at one end of the mile, and out, to see the job on the ground, he would jump, and, barking orders and questions at map-carrying aides, he would stride through the dust and the grime, seemingly oblivious to it, until he reached the other end of the mile, where the limousine, having crept around the side streets, would be waiting for him. The blasting was only intermittent, and it went on for no more than a year. But from the huge pit came also the harsh, staccato, machine-gun-like yammer of the jackhammers, the deep rat-tat-tat of the drills cutting holes for the dynamite, the clank and grind of the treads of the bulldozers, the hoarse bellow of the huge earth-moving equipment, and the heavy, jarring pound of the pile-drivers driving down the shafts of steel called long rock anchors to strengthen unstable formations, and, where the ground was soft, piles that would last for centuries, all combining in a roar that made the air shudder. The blasting was bad enough, but the roar was unbearable. It was the drilling, the constant drilling. You just heard it constantly through the day hours. You never got used to it. Worst of all, to these people for whom cleanliness was so important, was not the noise or the danger, but the dirt. One of the byproducts of blasting or drilling in solid bedrock is rock dust, an extremely fine-grained, abrasive grit. The grit, East Tremonters called it fallout, arose from the excavation in a continual fine mist. "It just filled the air," Lambert recalls. "If you closed your windows and put towels in to seal them up, it was there anyway. I don't know how. You got up in the morning, and you felt like you had slept in dust. When you came home from work, you couldn't sit down without sweeping it out of the chair. It was impossible to live cleanly. You felt like you were covered with silt all the time." Many of the stores nearest the area around the excavation, those on Southern Boulevard and Marmion, had been torn down. Reaching the others was difficult because they had been fenced for the duration of the construction work. Getting to East Tremont Avenue from the area on the south side of the expressway was difficult. When the expressway was completed, there would be overpasses to get across it, but the overpasses would not be built until it was finished, and many of the streets that would be left across it were closed for weeks at a time during various stages of construction. "To go shopping and come back with bundles was like going to Brooklyn," one housewife recalls. Families on the north side found it difficult to get across to the amenity on the south that was also an important part of their lives, Crotona Park. And worst of all, there was the uncertainty about when the construction work would be over. "It went on year after year, you know," explains Lambert. "Sometimes it would stop for a month or two, or 3 months, without any explanation being given, and then it would start up again. After a while, it seemed to have been going on forever." There were perhaps 10,000 people living right next to the excavation. They began to move out. Some of East Tremont's landlords, trapped for years in the squeeze between rising costs and rents that could be raised only when a tenant moved out, and cursed with tenants who seemed never to move out, welcomed the opportunity of replacing them with tenants whose poverty and lack of family stability ensured a higher turnover and more 15% increases, and whose lack of big city sophistication in dealing with landlords made it easier for landlords to skimp on services. The people moving into the vacated apartments were mostly Negroes, not the middle-class or lower-middle-class Negroes with whom East Tremont's middle-class and lower-middle-class Jews had found it easy to be compatible, but impoverished Negroes, many on welfare, many newly fled to New York from the rural slums of the Deep South, to whom the Jews found it impossible to relate, even had they wanted to. Frightened because the newcomers seemed the advance guard of the ravaging army that had previously been kept at bay on the far side of Crotona Park, they didn't want to. The vandalism started then all over the neighborhood, one housewife recalls. Furniture in apartment house lobbies was slashed, urinated on, and finally simply lugged boldly out, to be replaced, perhaps once, perhaps twice, but finally not to be replaced, so that the lobbies stood empty and bare. The walls of the elevators were marked by things sharp, were painted, were marked again, and finally not painted anymore. Break-ins began. New, stronger locks appeared in apartment doors, and then strips of steel to keep intruders from prying under the door jamb. The break-ins increased. Then there began to be the first terrifying reports of muggings. Still, most of East Tremont's people stayed. Their apartments were simply too precious to them for even fear to scare them away. In 1960, the year the expressway's East Tremont section opened, there were still, 4 years after demolition in the area had begun, an estimated 25,000 Jews in that neighborhood. Because most of the East Tremont section of the expressway runs through a deep cut, all one sees of the great road from adjoining streets is a gap in the ground. There is nothing visible rising out of that gap. But sit next to that gap, in one of the playgrounds that Moses built on excess condemnation parcels, or open the window in one of the apartments, approximately 3,000 apartments, whose windows face the gap during rush hour, when, down below, the expressway is packed solid with cars and trucks, 6 lanes across, and one soon realizes that something is rising from that gap, filling the air above and around it, filling it with something that, if one touched a match to it, would make it burn with a pale blue flame, the flame emitted by burning carbon monoxide. The human constitution apparently adapts itself to such fumes. One can sit next to the expressway for 5 days, observing it, and notice that by the 5th day, the nausea and headache and dizziness one felt at first are gone. But no one knows what the inhalation of carbon monoxide and assorted hydrocarbons emitted by automobile motors in diluted form produces, for no study has ever been done on the effect of prolonged exposure to such gases. Rising out of that gap in the ground also, concentrated by its high walls, is the noise of herds of cars and trucks. And that noise is much harder to get used to than the fumes. Talk to people who live in the 3,000 apartments next to the Cross Bronx Expressway, and one hears applied to that noise, over and over again, a single adjective: unbearable. At rush hours, the sound of a great expressway on the flat is the sound of the sea, a steady, surging roar. But the Cross Bronx Expressway in East Tremont is not flat. As the huge diesel tractor trailers, the monsters of the highways, come to each incline, they are forced, having been unable to maintain speed because of the creeping rush hour traffic, to shift gears and inch their way up the hill, accelerator pedal jammed hard to the floor. So the sound of the Cross Bronx Expressway at rush hour is a roar, punctuated by the snarl and grind of shifting gears and the snort and growl of acceleration, and, of course, the sudden, loud, harsh backfires. And all of this sound, magnified by the underpasses and the high brick walls that line the sides of the expressway cut, comes out of that cut and over the neighborhood as if out of a gigantic echo chamber. At nights, you should hear those trucks, says a man who lives a full block from the expressway. You should hear those trucks at 4 o'clock in the morning. It's noisy all the time, but you usually wake at about that time, and you can't get back to sleep. More people moved out of the buildings bordering the expressway. Some of the vacancies were filled by the type of family that would have filled them in the days before there was an expressway, for there were still tens of thousands of Jewish families in New York struggling to get out of the Lower East Side and other slums. But, with the noise, most moved out again, as fast as they could. And the families that replaced them were the families from the other side of the park. Muggings increased, and there began to be reports of robberies, thieves breaking right into your home. Before long, the old residents of the 3,000 apartments bordering the expressway were gone, moved away. Then the residents of the apartments next to those began to move, and then the residents of the apartments next to those. The demolition for the expressway had taken 5,000 of East Tremont's 60,000 residents. Now the expressway had forced out 10,000 more. The new, predominantly non-white residents, Saul Janowitz says, shopped to the south, in Morrisania, where they had always shopped. They didn't patronize East Tremont stores. As break-ins increased, insurance premiums began to soar. Merchants who had barely been making a living before weren't making one anymore. Storekeepers who had been in East Tremont for decades began to look for a way out. Many could find no buyers. When they moved out, their stores were simply boarded up. Each year, reports of muggings increased. Sometime in 1962 or 1963, exactly when isn't clear, a young, pretty teacher took her third-grade class to the park for the nature trip that East Tremont youngsters had been taking for generations. Details of the crime vary. It was never reported in the newspapers, but the neighborhood believes that a man with a knife forced her away from her class, took her to a deserted area of the park, and raped her. If there was a last straw, that was it. When word of the crime circulated, undoubtedly exaggerated in the telling, the people of East Tremont stopped using the park, and the young families that had always been attracted to East Tremont, moving into its big, roomy apartments when the older people who had lived in them died, moved in no longer. The people of East Tremont, particularly the young families whose breadwinners were not in cloaks and suits, but in the professions, and who could afford to live in the suburbs, or at least in Riverdale, moved out. Faster and faster they left, and faster, wider and wider, spread the urban decay. Still, what was left of the people of East Tremont tried to fight. They attempted to regroup in the community's northern reaches, a natural defensive position possessed of the strategic asset, a big and beautiful park, Bronx Park, from which they had been driven in the south and to which the forces of decay had not yet penetrated. There was one major weakness in the position. This northern section, immediately adjacent to the 180th Street station of the White Plains Elevated, had filled up about 15 years earlier than the southern. Its apartment houses were even older. And, since at the time they had been constructed, landlords had not been convinced that families moving up to the Bronx could afford significantly higher rents than they had been paying on the Lower East Side, those apartment houses were of cheaper construction. By 1960, they were in far worse condition than those in the southern section, too, that Moses had destroyed. Couples already living there were used to it, but it would not attract younger couples, a consideration important to East Tremont, which felt, as Barney Lambert put it, that if young people want to move into the same area in which they grew up, they ought to be able to do it. But, the community felt, this weakness could be remedied. The papers were full of new programs for the city. Title I, Mitchell Llama, which, the papers said, were designed to provide housing at rents that people could afford to pay. Lillian Edelstein was gone, as were most of Etna's old leaders, who, having lived in the destroyed southern section of the community, were no longer part of it. But the community found new leaders, including Lambert and Vivian D., an eager, vivacious young housewife. Under the auspices of the East Tremont Neighborhood House, they worked up a plan for a Title I development called Bronx Park South, brought Lyons and every other politician who seemed interested in on the planning from the beginning, and one day in 1959 found themselves, to their shock, accompanying the borough president to Randall's Island for an appointment, a personal appointment, with the mayor's committee on slum clearance, Robert Moses, chairman. In a smaller room, his personality was even more overwhelming than in the Board of Estimate chamber, Lambert recalls. But this time he was cordial. With a grin that filled the room, he began the meeting by saying to Lyons, "Well, Jim, what can I do for you?" And when Lyons told him, he said he would do it. Knowing his power, Lambert and the rest of the committee were optimistic. "It was refreshing to have him on our side," he would recall. But Moses' concept of the project soon expanded. While Etna had conceived of it as one of limited size, limited to an area of run-down tenements so as not to hurt sound housing in the area, Under Moses, it was, to their dismay, expanded into a huge concept of 5,400 units that would destroy no fewer than 24 of the best remaining.